So you're seeing this more in the past couple of years, where you see founders, while they're starting their business, they're running a podcast, or they're building a community on Slack, or they're really active on social media, and they're a thought leader. That is a persona that, even in this modern era of social media and whatnot, I think that's a persona that's still undervalued.
You're listening to Mastering Remote, the podcast that gives you expert advice to help you work smarter and manage better remotely. In today's episode, I'll be talking to Joe Blair, an early stage VC at Coda Capital. He shares expert tips to help you ace your next VC interview, how you can overcome the trust deficit and get funded remotely, and how you can overcome unexpected challenges along your founder journey. Let's jump right in. Can you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and Coda Capital?
Yes, of course. I'm Joe Blair. I'm originally from the New York and Connecticut area. I was an engineer turned entrepreneur turned venture investor. So that's my trajectory. I've been in venture investing on the West Coast for the past 7 years since graduating business school. And I currently work for a firm called Coda Capital. We are a SF-based firm that's SEC-registered, multi-stage, and we broadly invest in enterprise tech companies. We uniquely invest across both public and private companies, which is not typical in the Bay Area, and we've invested in about 100 companies to date. I've been interested in remote work as an investment category for the past 2 years or so, before it was cool, I guess you could say. And happy to talk about my journey through remote work, but I've been investing in remote work for about that time and do a lot of advocacy and thinking about the space.
So historically, VCs have been pretty skeptical to invest in remote companies. What are you seeing in terms of VC appetite towards remote companies now, post-COVID-19?
Yeah, excellent question. I would prefer to segment that question into two different parts. On one part, there is the whole category of remote work tools and remote work productivity tools. That's number one. And number two would be companies, regardless of what they're building, that happen to be remote first internally. So just taking those separately, in the first category, I think what we're seeing is a major appetite from VCs to invest in those categories. You're seeing that in some of the valuations, companies like Miro and Deal and Remote.com, Mural, Notion. So I think you're seeing that in the valuations, as well as the pace of how soon some of these companies raise after their previous round, right? So rather than taking 18 months, I think just because of the appetite from VCs, you're seeing rounds that are happening within 6 months of a company closing a previous round. So I think there's a lot of excitement there. The flip side of that, which always happens, is you have some VCs saying like, well, now it's an overhyped space and valuations are too high and whatnot. And so there's a healthy debate over on that side. The second category is perhaps more interesting, which is how are VCs viewing remote companies internally? And I would say historically, if you look at the history of VC, VC's always been sort of a cottage industry where people are really looking in their backyards. And that's why Silicon Valley has such network effects and clustering effects, because there's such a concentration of capital as well as concentration of entrepreneurs and tech folks who are starting companies. And then you have VCs that specialize in developing communities of startups and founders in New York and Seattle and Austin and whatnot that can be quite successful there. But with this change, I think VCs are starting to realize, A, you can't just invest in your backyard. B, whereas you used to be able to invest in maybe a company across the country, but you could go visit them, they could come visit you. That's changed too. So you have to get comfortable as a VC with investing in potentially a founder you've never met. And then the third piece is, traditionally, as a VC, you want all the founders in the same building, in the same room, and not just the founders, but the whole team. But that's no longer becoming relevant and becoming a reality, especially, I would argue, if you want to invest in the first category, which is the remote tools companies, because oftentimes they eat their own dog food and they are remote first companies internally themselves. So if you want to be a modern VC, you have to become comfortable with remote work yourself internally. And that includes investing in companies that are not in your backyard. That includes investing in companies that are dispersed as a remote strategy? And third, like once you make the investment, managing those companies and keeping close relationships with those companies, whether on a board level or on an ongoing basis. So all these things are changing for VCs, and there's a spectrum of how well VCs are adapting to that new landscape.
I'm really interested to know for you personally, what kind of companies are you really excited about right now?
What I'm interested in right now is specifically on this topic of remote work. It's not just limited to what's the next remote productivity tool. It's thinking more holistically around, we had this black swan event, which is the pandemic. It created this global work from home breakthrough in terms of the psychological barriers we talked about. So the question that I'm really intrigued by right now is, what are the short-term and long-term implications of that shift beyond just productivity, but in every sector of our economy? That's really one of the questions that we're seeking to, or at least start answering in the upcoming Remote Startup Expo coming up on October 14th, which is, who's winning in the new normal? So to give you a few examples, there are companies that, and if you talk to a bunch of VCs, you'll find in every VC portfolio, they have one or two companies that when COVID started, they were expecting that company to be on the triage list. Like, oh boy, we really got to worry about this company, or how can we support them? And then unexpectedly, they have these tailwinds and they're just taking off. So that includes companies across healthcare, education, commerce, infrastructure, and beyond. So those are the types of founders and CEOs that we have coming to speak at the event. So it's not one specific sector. It's not one specific technology. It's the intersection of how this is all coming together post-pandemic and global work from home. So that's what I'm most interested in, is figuring out that answer to that question.
Let's talk about the interview process. When founders are pitching to you, what kinds of tactics and strategies do you think work really well?
Yeah, one just very quick tactic that I recognize in terms of pattern net matching is, I find that the best entrepreneurs at the very beginning of a discussion with a VC will ask the VC to start talking first. We'll say, hey, tell me about your firm. Tell me about how you're different than all the other firms and how you add value to the companies that you invest in. And whenever I see that, I pay attention a little bit more closely, because it makes me feel like they have discriminating tastes when it comes to who they want to work with. Just like dating, it's sort of a cat and mouse type of a game where you don't want to give the impression that you're desperate and, you know, you'll work with anyone. You want to give the impression that you know your value and you want to work with someone of similar value, that where you can both bring things to the table. So as a tactic, I think that's quite effective. And there are a whole host of other things that I look for and that VCs will look for across. What does the team look like? What's their background? What are their experiences? What's their unique insight? One thing I usually look for is, anyone can come up with an idea, and ideas are a dime a dozen, but do you have a specific insight that is unique or was derived from a unique experience? And then have you amassed the team that's going to be one of the best teams in the world to execute on that plan? So it's a combination of the right insight, the right team, and then the right execution plan. And then layered on top of that, of course, is all the preparation and other tactical things you can do to, like, know your pitch backwards and forwards, to prepare very strong and well-designed materials. And then the last piece would just be practice. You can't go pitch to 10 VCs and expect to get a term sheet unless you've done it a million times. If you're relatively new to the pitch game, you need to build the funnel just like you would in sales. You need to have a very wide funnel, and you need to pitch to as many people as possible, because over time you will get better, your pitch will get better, and you'll become more comfortable. So that's what I would advise for who's fundraising and pitching a VC.
Now, for founders out there who might have to pitch to a VC over a video call, what advice do you have to overcome that trust deficit of not being in the same room together?
There are two things. One would be that the bar for pitch materials is higher virtually, because you can't rely as much on your personality in the room being able to take over. I think having very well-crafted materials, showing a narrative that helps me as the VC walk through that logic, ideally before the call, is the best. But even during the call, the bar is even higher. So more preparation and more work on the materials is important. And then the second piece would be, outside of the pitch, would be your, like, social capital between yourselves and the investor. basically just understanding who you know in common with that person. And that can both help you get the initial meeting, but as well as strengthen that credibility that you have as, hey, I'm not just some random person in some random part of the world that might be trying to mislead you in some way. It's more like, hey, we all know the same people, or at least we have a few people in common that can provide a credibility for me as an entrepreneur.
Okay, if we're going to talk tough love for founders, what are the biggest challenges you think founders may not be aware of, but should be?
Number one would be, I would say, downside to this whole remote situation. I think because of the old school psychological barrier that some VCs have, there's a added level of comfort, I think, with people who happen to be in your physical vicinity, even if you can't physically or have no plans to physically visit them. And I've just been noticing this, and I'm not saying it's the right thing or that this is the way it should be, but I think if you're physically located in a similar area as someone, I think it helps psychologically. And that's kind of an unfair truth that I think you either need to take advantage of if you happen to be there, or just acknowledge and overcome if you're not there. The second thing is just be prepared for this resistance, I think, generally to remote first teams that aren't physically located in the same area. Again, like, I'm not saying that's right or fair, and I try not to have that bias, but I think it is a subconscious bias that many teams feel. Like, how serious is this team? Are they just goofing around on the weekends, or is this something they're both really committed to? I would say those are the main two things just to be aware of. Not that you can necessarily change them or even that you should change them, but you should be aware of some of those biases that exist.
That's the reality, yeah. Now I'm curious, are there any indicators of the successful founder or something that really matters to you?
One persona that I'm attracted to right now is the persona of the founder who's also a community leader. So you're seeing this more in the past couple of years, where you see founders, while they're starting their business, they're running a podcast, or they're building a community on Slack, or they're really active on social media and they're a thought leader. That is a persona that, even in this modern era of social media and whatnot, I think that's a persona that's still undervalued. I think people, especially for like first-time founders, it's a unique edge that can provide you some real business advantages in the short and long term. To summarize it, I would say someone who is a thought leader and can amass attention from peers in a specific niche, in some cases, even before they have a real market-ready product, is super intriguing to me. So that's something to consider, is just like thinking outside the box. It's not necessarily just about the pitch and who I know. It's like, what can you do outside of that to really show that you're in the movement?
How would you describe the change in terms of interest in remote work since the pandemic started?
Massive change. When I started to get interested in this space, I was actually coming at it through the lens of mobility. At my previous firm, I was investing in mobility companies. I invested in an on-demand electric air taxi company in Germany called Lilium. The vision there is, what if you could live in Napa Valley and commute to San Francisco? Instead of it taking 2 hours, it could take 20 minutes, something like that. So I started thinking harder about where people work, live, and play, and how that would change with a new transportation modality. And then I just started thinking about that at the limit, which is, what if we didn't need to live where we worked? And this came to a head for me when I was actually in Wyoming at a Silicon Valley roundtable with the governor. And we were all batting our heads against the walls, trying to figure out, how do we get Silicon Valley companies to set up satellite headquarters in Wyoming? And I was just struck by the irony where there I am sitting in this beautiful log cabin mansion with snow-capped peaks all around me. And we're trying to figure out how to get humans to live in this place where I would want to move yesterday. So the more I thought about it, what kind of haunted me was the fact that it is not a technology issue. And it wasn't then and it's not now. There was no technology reason why people couldn't live and work remotely. It was more of a psychological issue. I was perplexed and intrigued by that question. So that's what got me intrigued. So fast forward to about 1 year ago, last October, I met Ho-Yin Chung, the founder of Remo, who I think you know. And we kind of hit it off and we thought, hey, let's just for fun, since this remote work thing is still kind of a new idea and a niche community, let's put together like a little remote summit on remote work. So we did a little proof of concept event that was about 30 people. And the whole conversation was really around, is remote really going to happen? When's it going to happen? How far out is this transformation really going to happen? Because we see all these benefits, but at the time, still a very nascent and niche idea. So fast forward to COVID happening. And then, as we all know, we all became remote workers overnight. That's what inspired me to do another event called the Remote Startup Expo, which was in April. And that's a much bigger event. It was also on the Remo platform, but we had CEOs and founders of Threads, Loom, Deal, Remote.com, Tandem Chat, et cetera. And we had 450 people show up. And then we're doing another one in October. Long story short, everything changed. And the quote I'm using and partially stealing, a lot of people think that this whole remote work trend is overhyped. I believe that it's still underhyped. Like, we're still trying to wrap our heads around what this actually means for our broader economy, and not just this little niche, but everyone. So that's my thoughts on what's changed.
On a slightly different note, I'd like to ask you about your podcast. So it's called the Epic Human Podcast, and I'm really curious to hear from you. What do you think makes an epic human? Because throughout your career, I'm sure you've encountered many different types of people. So I'm curious how you define this.
It's probably worth mentioning that the podcast was inspired by my grandmother, whose name is Eileen Blair. She's a woman who grew up in rural Jamaica in extraordinarily poor and difficult circumstances, lived in a two-bedroom house with seven brothers and sisters, had to beg for food, had to beg for clothes, et cetera. And then miraculously met my grandfather in Jamaica, immigrated to the U.S. in the 50s to New York City. And then they grew a family, they grew a business, they basically experienced the American dream. So what happened was about 10, 12 years ago, I was down in Florida visiting my grandmother. By that time, my grandfather had passed, so she was living alone. And I got the sense, just this feeling that this was one of the last times I was going to have a one-on-one interaction with her. And this was in the early days of smartphones. I got an Android at the time. So I basically sat down with her and I was like, listen, tell me all the stories from the old days. And she was always great at telling you stories. And she had this amazing Jamaican accent that was very much her own. So we sat down for like 3 days and had her retell all the stories from Jamaica, from New York, and so on. And I recorded them on my smartphone. Now, I've been very public about this, is that I'm a little bit ashamed in that I did not ask her permission, but it's because she was sort of a private person and I knew she would say no. And if she said no, then we would lose as a family all those stories. And lo and behold, she ended up passing, unfortunately, a couple years after that. And then we all went down to Florida for the wake, the funeral, and we listened to those stories as a family. And it was just a light bulb moment for me of like, wow, the power of the human voice, the power of stories from ordinary people. Like, this woman is not a famous person, right? But her stories and the stories of so many people that you and I know are just incredibly compelling. So when I think about an epic human, I, of course, inspired by her, but to generalize, I would say people who overcome odds, people who are risk takers, and people who are very hard workers, and that hard work leads to high performance in any measure or any activity or any facet of the life, whether it's professional or non-professional. So that's the way I think about the Epic Human Podcast. We have folks from VC, we have folks that are founders, but also athletes, professors, authors. So it really runs the gamut, and anyone who fits those descriptions.
Awesome. I love that. All right. So I like to end each interview with a few fun questions, ending on the lighter side. So what's the first thing you do in the morning and the last thing you do at night?
Okay, so when I'm at my best, I will wake up at 3:45 a.m. and I will work out at 4 a.m. for about an hour. Sometimes when I'm not at my best, I will use that time to work, which I don't recommend. But that's my morning routine that I try to stick to. And then in the evenings, because I wake up so early at night, I'm usually washing dishes and cleaning up around the house. As soon as I'm done with everything, I just crash and I just go to bed. I have very little trouble sleeping, generally.
You know, that's a good problem to have, to be able to fall asleep so easily. Now, who's the most interesting person you follow on Twitter?
Two that come to mind. One is Del Johnson. He's at Del Johnson VC. He's a New York-based VC who's been very outspoken and witty and humorous despite everything that's happened in terms of civil rights movement here in the U.S., And then another would be Girl Alex, who's another VC that I've been friends with on Twitter for a while. And we recently just met. And I would say the common thread between those two and people generally I enjoy would be irreverent, witty, humorous, but also good-hearted and grounded in ethics. So I'd recommend those people to anybody.
What blog or newsletter do you recommend people subscribe to?
This is a tough one. I don't actually subscribe to many blogs these days just because I do so much reading in my day-to-day work, but I am an audiophile. So the podcast I'd recommend right now, which is like a lesser known podcast so far because it's new, is one called Positive with a 2 for the T. And it's by a friend of mine named Zeka, who's a phenomenal host and is really trying to unpack impact and what that means across a number of dimensions. And he actually had me on to discuss diversity and inclusion as related to remote work. So that's a podcast that people can check out.
What's the non-obvious remote work tool that you can't live without? So not Zoom, not Slack, something else.
Yeah, so this is probably going to be an unexpected answer, but it's actually the light that's illuminating me right now, which plugs into my USB port. It really makes a big difference because I've always been that guy that's in the shadows and in like a dark apartment. So I'd recommend that.
If you weren't an entrepreneur or VC, what job would you love to do?
What comes to mind for me is stand-up comedian. And I don't claim to be intelligent or funny enough to be one, but I do love making people laugh, especially my kids. So maybe I would specialize in a stand-up comedian for children.
Okay, well, one final question. What book has had the greatest impact on you?
That's a very deep question. There's a number that I could mention, but the one that comes to mind, again, it's an audiobook. It's a very old book. It's called Lead the Field by Earl Nightingale. And it came out in 1968. And this was an audiobook that my dad had on cassette. And anytime we went on long car trips, he would always pop it in. And in the early days, I was very resistant, like, what's this self-help kind of thing? But I think the brainwashing worked because it's the type of thing I still listen to about once a year. And it just has these like kind of timeless truths about how to live a life of value. And again, it was made in 1968. So in some ways, it's a little bit outdated and you have to translate it to the modern context. But I think some of those inherent philosophical truths still remain true today.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Joe. It's been wonderful having you and we'll see you next time.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me, Christine.
Thanks for listening to Mastering Remote, a podcast brought to you by Arc. We make it easy for you to hire senior remote developers, pre-vetted and tailor-matched to you. Check us out at arc.dev. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please subscribe to Mastering Remote to be the first to know when our newest episodes go live. See you next time.